Chapter 6, The Mother. The four powers of the mother are four of her outstanding personalities, portions and embodiments of her divinity, through whom she acts on her creatures, orders and harmonizes her creations in the worlds, and directs the working out of her thousand forces. For the mother is one, but she comes before us with differing aspects. Many are her powers and personalities, many her emanations and vibhutis that do her work in the universe. The one whom we adore as the mother is the divine conscious force that dominates all existence, one and yet so many-sided that to follow her movement is impossible even for the quickest mind and for the freest and most vast intelligence. The mother is the consciousness and force of the Supreme, and far above all she creates. But something of her ways can be seen and felt through her embodiments, and the more seizable, because more defined and limited temperament and action of the goddess forms in whom she consents to be manifest to her creatures. There are three ways of being of the mother, of which you can become aware when you enter into touch of oneness with the conscious force that upholds us and the universe. Transcendent, the original supreme Shakti, she stands above the worlds and links the creation to the ever-unmanifest mystery of the Supreme. Universal, the cosmic Mahashakti, she creates all these beings and contains and enters, supports and conducts all these million processes and forces. Individual, she embodies the power of these two vaster ways of her existence, makes them living and near to us, and mediates between the human personality and the divine nature. The one original transcendent Shakti, the mother stands above all the worlds and bears in her eternal consciousness the supreme divine. Alone, she harbors the absolute power and the ineffable presence, containing or calling the truths that have to be manifested, she brings them down from the mystery in which they were hidden into the light of her infinite consciousness and gives them a form of force in her omnipotent power and her boundless life and a body in the universe. The Supreme is manifest in her forever as the everlasting Satchit Ananda, manifested through her in the worlds as the one and dual consciousness of Ishwara Shakti and the dual principle of Purusha Prakriti, embodied by her in the worlds and the planes and the gods and their energies, and figured because of her as all that is in the known worlds and in unknown others. All is her play with the Supreme. All is her manifestation of the mysteries of the eternal, the miracles of the infinite. All is she, for all are parcel and portion of the divine conscious force. Nothing can be here or elsewhere but what she decides and the Supreme sanctions. Nothing can take shape except what she, moved by the Supreme, perceives and forms after casting it into seed in her creating Ananda. The Mahashakti, the Universal Mother, works out whatever is transmitted by her transcendent consciousness from the Supreme and enters into the worlds that she has made. Her presence fills and supports them with the divine spirit and the divine all-sustaining force and delight, without which they could not exist. That which we call nature or Prakriti is only her most outward executive aspect. She marshals and arranges the harmony of her forces and processes, impels the operations of nature, and moves among them, secret or manifest, in all that can be seen or experienced or put into motion of life. Each of the worlds is nothing but one play of the Mahashakti, of that system of worlds or universe, who is there as the cosmic soul and personality of the Transcendent Mother. Each is something that she has seen in her vision, gathered into her heart of beauty and power, and created in her Ananda. We'll pause in our reading there. We have seen that chapters 1 through 5, what we call the Mother, were formed from first a message on the Mother's birthday on the 21st of February, 1927, and then four letters written to disciples who received them all the way up to, let's say, August of 1927. Now, Sri Aurobindo turns to this final section of the book and writes a letter to Poonam Chand Shah, who's in Gujarat, trying to raise money for the Sri Aurobindo Ashram. He writes on the 3rd of October, 1927, saying that he's about halfway finished with the chapter on the four aspects, which will then be a concluding section of a book that is intended to be published soon thereafter. The book finally is published and distributed in April of the following year, 1928. So we know that roughly around this time of the month, in October of 1927, Sri Aurobindo was likely bringing to completion his writing of this sixth chapter. So it's an auspicious occasion. Auspicious then and now, because likely we would be in or around Navaratri, leading up to Durga Puja, the celebration of the Divine Mother's conquest of darkness, putting down the Asura, putting down the figure who would distort and disrail the whole enginery of the cosmos. So Sri Aurobindo was writing this at an auspicious moment. This book has many features in it which, without direct reference, have a background in the long Indian tradition. The worship of the goddess in India, the worship of the goddess around the world, is immemorial. We find it in Neolithic civilizations, east and west. We find it always alive in India throughout its rural history, and coming to make a definite imprint even in the life of urban centers in India as we go along. True, in the Rig Veda, we have one significant hymn dedicated to the goddess of speech, Vat. And in the Kena Upanishad, we have a manifestation appearing of the Divine Mother in her aspect of knowledge. And we have the mention in the Gita of Paraprakriti. So there is, even in the Vedic and Vedantic tradition, some continuity, some recognition of the nature of the Divine Mother, but we find it most powerfully represented in the Tantric tradition. There, the worship of the supreme energy of the universe, the Shakti, here Sri Aurobindo refers to her as the Mahashakti, is really decisive. And the oldest texts that we have in which are enshrined the worship of the Divine Mother is the Devi Mahatmyam. We can say certainly that it must have existed between 400, 600 CE, so let's say 500 CE. And maybe 500 to 700 years later, the Devi Bhagavata Purana comes into being, which takes the initial ideas expressed in the Devi Mahatmyam and completes them philosophically, reworks some of the mythology. But what is core in the Devi Mahatmya is the recognition that there is a supreme being who is the Devi. Here, the goddess has no consort. There are gods about, there are other goddess figures about, but she is not aligned or subordinate or simply standing next to anyone. She is supreme. And of course, this is arising before Shankaracharya has come and in a sense reworked the Vedantic tradition to be detached from the manifestation of the divine as this world. So, when we look at Devi Mahatmyam, we see that the goddess can be recognized as that which is transcendent to the cosmos, beyond the cosmos, beyond any qualification, nirguna. She is not this, she is not that. She is Mahadevi, she is also Mahasuri, the great demoness, because she's a reality that is beyond any classification, any categorization, and yet she indwells all things in this universe because, yes, there is the manifestation from that nirguna in a saguna form with qualities as this many-stationed, many-leveled universe, from gods all the way down to worms crawling on the earth. All things are manifestations of this great Shakti. But she is not simply that. This aspect of her brings her power as that which measures out and finitizes the infinite, that is to say Maya, into play. So as Nirguna, she is the absolute. She is the transcendent. There is no subject. There is no object. There is no self because there is nothing other than she. But in the universe, there is multiplicity. There is the play of self in the world. There is the distinctions upon which we rely when we look at the world and know securely that I am me and you are you. But all are that goddess only. Then, beyond the nirguna aspect, beyond the Shakti aspect, there is the aspect of her as Prakriti, that she becomes this world of mind, life, and matter. Even though you cannot look at this world and say, ah, there is the divinity, you can't grasp it with your senses, you can't measure it with your mind, yet, to deeper experience, you find that she has stationed herself even in what seems to be ignorant, in what seems to be the denial of the integrity of her being. So she's truly awesome. She's beyond all measure. She is all measurement itself, and she is ingrained in the infinitesimally small and discrete. Everywhere you look, you see only that one. The one, as Sri Aurobindo says, whom we adore as the mother. So I mentioned the Devi Bhagavatam that was composed around 1000 to 1200 CE, and it's certainly a Shakta Purana. We won't dwell much on that tonight, but I expect that you would permit me to return to it as we go along. Let's look at some of these sentences. The four powers of the mother are four of her outstanding personalities. Well, we'll know shortly which she's speaking about. But these goddess powers appear in many of these texts, in the Devi Mahatmyam, in the Bengali worship of the Supreme Mother. These mahas are invoked continually, but with special force and special attention at this time of the year. We're in the middle of Navaratri, Durga Puja. The crowning 10th day is only a few days away from us. I think, depending on where you are in India or America, it's roughly the 5th or maybe the 6th day of the celebration. And all of these goddess powers have their day in the train of events. But all of these goddess powers are representations of the One. As he says, they are portions and embodiments of her divinity. She uses these powers and other powers to manifest consciously the world, to distribute from her infinite reserve all the stadia of the universe. For the mother is one, but she comes before us with differing aspects, and these are the goddess powers that we see when we look at her. All the work being done in the world, whether through these goddess powers or through conscious agencies or even unconscious agencies, or again, her. It's her enginery, her conscious enginery, which is at work. But the One is the divine conscious force, the Chit Shakti. Even the liberated human mind, attempting to gain identity and equality with the Supreme, in that experience, in that merger of self into that, cannot fathom the scope. It becomes one with it, but it does not possess it and cannot know it utterly. She remains always mysterious above, the unknowable. It is when she steps forward into creation that we come to see these other goddess powers, or even to regard her as the Mahashakti, from whom these four are the predominant manifestations that we can know in our intimate experience, representing, as they do, knowledge and power, and beauty and prosperity, and perfection in work. So, first you can become aware of the Chit Shakti in three ways. He says, transcendent, the original supreme Shakti. She stands above the worlds. This is that which exists in sheer oneness. She has not manifested yet. She's above in immaculate being. We can't say anything about that. It is unknowable. Literally, how we know is to see an object and to measure it, to become familiar with it. That kind of knowledge is useless. With this, you cannot know. Universal. This is that aspect where in the Devi Mahatmya and here in Sri Aurobindo's book, we have this description of an energy emerging from that absolute oneness and standing forth with the intent, with the will to manifest. It is a conscious force. It is taking this infinite, focusing it through an act of consciousness, and pushing it out into the world. And thus we come into being. Thus this universe comes into being. Not as an accident, it's not adventitious, it is willed by the Supreme Shakti that this universe should arise, which means that she accepts responsibility for its maintenance and for its conduct. Hence the need to come to change the direction of things from time to time in a way that suits her inner sense of a just and proper course. It doesn't have to match human reason or our linear expectations, but it has to fit with the rhythms with which she decides to install upon the cosmos. Finally, individual. She manifests that transcendence and that universality. Remember, there is a context for this book. Sri Aurobindo and the mother formed deliberately a community which would live and work together for the manifestation of a divine consciousness upon earth through not only an awakened individual, but through an increasingly enlightened collectivity. When Sri Aurobindo brought the mother to the front, there were elements within even that small community who didn't understand, couldn't gauge, couldn't assess, would not accept who she was without a greater explanation from him. He had retired from the scene after November 24th, 1926. No one had daily access to him. So there was a call. Explain to us who she is. If you want us to raise money for the ashram from outside, tell us why we are doing this. Define for us. And so Sri Aurobindo is expressing what is his deep conviction, what is his personal experience with the one that we formerly called Mira Alfasa, Mira Rishar. She is now the mother. And he is saying plainly who he experiences her to be. And hence, these three great ways of being, the transcendent, the universal, and the individual, all come to point in her. She is not simply a human struggling upwards from ego, trying to find the reality of the soul behind. She is instead something that comes descending from above. Something who must be sempiternal in its embrace of the cosmos and its development. Something which must have a pointed mission to agree to assume the human birth. And he will get to that in subsequent paragraphs. But both the transcendence and the universality are visible, palpable to Sri Aurobindo's experience and to many who are in the ashram with them. But still, he felt the need to make this statement about who she is because he is promulgating this idea of a community which will come to manifest a next wave of conscious evolution, and which, as it takes root in the community, will then extend itself naturally into the wider world. So there's an idea that first we realize, we commit to Earth the nature of this realization. We bring it into this spiritual family, which is targeted here for that. And then we share it with the globe. We take it to any receptive agent. Now, this is a many-sided work. The primary work is inner, it's yogic. But the yogic work must extend itself and must preserve the physical base. And so Sri Aurobindo has, with growing numbers of people coming, a need to bring the material, the vital, the intellectual, the spiritual resources that are needed into the common life. And so, this book, when it's published in April 1928, will be the first invitation to the world in general, by which you can come to know what is the nature of Sri Aurobindo's yoga. It isn't the life divine, it isn't Essays on the Gita that goes out to announce this ashram to the world. It is this book, The Mother. And central to it all is this person who before had been behind the scenes, secluded from view, increasingly brought forward, and then finally, like the rising sun, introduced to all as the mother in late 1926. And now it's 1927, and the work has to get underway. So Sri Aurobindo describes her in these terms. Transcendent, universal, individual in her person. And now he returns to philosophy. The one original transcendent Shakti. The mother stands above all the worlds and bears in her eternal consciousness the supreme divine. So, here there is no distinction. Here there is only oneness, yes? The supreme divine exists in her consciousness. She harbors the absolute power, the Shakti, and the ineffable presence. That's the being. So, Chit Shakti and Sat are there. You'll remember from The Life Divine how important the concept of Sat Chit Ananda is to Sri Aurobindo. It's even a more important concept to him than the supramental, which is the next stage of evolution which we must attain. It is Sat Chit Ananda that establishes the reality of the world and uses the supramental to discharge its energies into play, creating a constellated harmonious cosmos. It affects what it sees. It is what it knows, and it knows what it is in form. Alone, she harbors the absolute power and the ineffable presence. Containing or calling the truths that have to be manifested, she brings them down from the mystery, that nirguna, that unknowable, in which they were hidden, into the light of her infinite consciousness, and gives them a form of force in her omnipotent power and her boundless life and a body in the universe. The Supreme is manifest in her forever as the everlasting Satchit Ananda. In Sri Lalita Sahasranama, the 700th verse, she is described as Satchit Ananda Rupani, she who takes the form of Satchit Ananda. If you can imagine that which is infinite in a form, manifested through her in the worlds as the one and dual consciousness of Ishvara Shakti. So if Satchit Ananda is unimaginable, unwalled existence, consciousness, and delight, Ishvara Shakti speaks to the manifestation of that same infinite consciousness. And then, the dual principle of Purusha Prakriti. If Ishvara and Shakti are actually the same thing, but one is the Lord and one is the executive power of the Lord, which moves out and accomplishes. There we have the two-in-one that Sri Aurobindo describes in his great epic poem, Savitri. But he goes on, and the dual principle of Purusha Prakriti, where we have a manifestation, mind, life, body, but we have also the power of looking at this manifestation, of discovering the spiritual element in ourselves, which stands distinct from that, and can, in a sense, remember the essence of what it is. So we have dualism, we have a two-in-one-ism, and we have an absolute Unitarian view of things, all involved here. So Sri Aurobindo has covered the gamut of philosophic possibilities in these couple of sentences. All of this is at play in the consciousness of the Divine Mother, who is transcendent, universal, and yes, individual. Embodied by her in the worlds and the planes and the gods in their energies, the gods oversee the conduct of the powers of harmonic expression that they're in charge of, and they work well together. See, the cosmos doesn't fly apart. But it is really her being and her will which is being conducted by them. And the Upanishads have amusing passages where the gods have to awaken up to the fact that it is this Brahman, that really, this divine reality behind, that really causes them to move. Not they themselves are the cause of their action, but it is action caused in them by a greater will unknown to them. Still, they have their place in the world. All is her play with the Supreme, he says. All is her manifestation of the mysteries of the eternal, the miracles of the infinite, being done through the gods, manifesting the world, and then moving up from below to rejoin these greater forces. All is she. For all are parcel and portion of the divine conscious force. And this also, Devi Mahatmyam says. She says, all this is me. Show me a second. Where is there a second? She says. In other words, she is the only reality. Whatever you look at, you see the great goddess above, you see the great demoness, both are part, both are reconciled in my larger, greater being. All are manifestations of me. And it is ignorance that makes us think that it is other. We choose the good. When the divine is larger than the mere good, nothing can be here or elsewhere, but what she decides and the supreme sanctions. Swallow hard. Nothing can take shape, except what she, moved by the supreme, perceives and forms after casting it into seed in her, creating Ananda. So, there is the being, the supreme. There is the conscious force, the chit, sat and chit. But it is Ananda, the overflowing experience of delight, which throws out the world in a grand gesture. A beautiful piece of drama is the world, filled with the very sap of existence. Coming from Ananda, supported by true being, an expression of the supreme consciousness, how can it end badly? Have a bit of faith. I think I'd like to read a couple of passages from Savitri tonight. So if you don't mind, I think we'll put our bookmark here and we'll continue in the sixth chapter next time. This is in Book 2, The Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 1, The World Stare. There, walled apart by its own innerness, in a mystical barrage of dynamic light, he saw a lone, immense, high-curved world pile, erect like a mountain chariot of the gods, motionless under an inscrutable sky. As if from matter's plinth and viewless base to a view as top, to a top as viewless, a carved sea of worlds climbing with foam-maned waves to the supreme, ascended towards breadths immeasurable. It hoped to soar into the ineffable's reign. 100 levels raised it to the unknown. So it towered up to heights intangible and disappeared in the hushed conscious vast, as climbs a storied temple tower to heaven, built by the aspiring soul of man to live near to his dream of the invisible. Infinity calls to it as it dreams and climbs. Its spire touches the apex of the world, mounting into great voiceless stillnesses. It marries the earth to screened eternities. Amid the many systems of the One, made by an interpreting creative joy, alone it points us to our journey back out of our long self-loss in nature's deeps. Planted on earth, it holds in it all realms. It is a brief compendium of the vast. This was the single stair to being's goal. A summary of the stages of the spirit, its copy of the cosmic hierarchies, refashioned in our secret air of self, a subtle pattern of the universe. It is within, below, without, above. Acting upon this visible nature's scheme, it wakens our earth matter's heavy doze to think and feel and to react to joy. It models in us our diviner parts, lifts mortal mind into a greater air, makes yearn this life of flesh to intangible aims, links the body's death with immortality's call. Out of the swoon of the inconscience, it labors towards a superconscient light. If earth were all, and this were not in her, thought could not be, nor life delight's response. Only material forms could then be her guests, driven by an inanimate world force. Earth, by this golden superfluity, bore thinking man, and more than man shall bear. This higher scheme of being is our cause, and holds the key to our ascending fate. It calls out of our dense mortality the conscious spirit nursed in matter's house. The living symbol of these conscious planes, its influences and godheads of the unseen, its unthought logic of reality's acts, arisen from the unspoken truth in things, have fixed our inner life's slow-scale degrees. Its steps are paces of the soul's return from the deep adventure of material birth, a ladder of delivering ascent and rungs that nature climbs to deity. Once in the vigil of a deathless gaze, these grades had marked her giant downward plunge, the wide and prone leap of a godhead's fall. Our life is a holocaust of the supreme. The great world mother, by her sacrifice, has made her soul the body of our state. Accepting sorrow and unconsciousness, divinity's lapse from its own splendors wove the many-patterned ground of all we are. And this is from Book 7, the Book of Yoga, The Triple Soul Forces. O Savitri, I am thy secret soul. I have come down into the human world, and the movement watched by an unsleeping eye, and the dark contrariety of earth's fate, and the battle of the bright and somber powers. I stand upon earth's paths of danger and grief, and help the unfortunate and save the doomed. To the strong I bring the guerdon of their strength. To the weak, I bring the armor of my force. To men who long, I carry their coveted joy. I am fortune, justifying the great and wise by the sanction of the plaudits of the crowd, then trampling them with the armed heel of fate. My ear is leaned to the cry of the oppressed. I topple down the thrones of tyrant kings. A cry comes from proscribed and hunted lives, appealing to me against a pitiless world, a voice of the forsaken and desolate, and the lone prisoner in his dungeon cell. Men hail in my coming the Almighty's force, or praise with thankful tears his Savior grace. I smite the Titan who bestrides the world, and slay the ogre in his blood-stained den. I am Durga, goddess of the proud and strong, and Lakshmi, queen of the fair and fortunate. I wear the face of Kali when I kill. I trample the corpses of the demon horns. I am charged by God to do his mighty work. Uncaring, I serve his will who sent me forth, reckless of peril and earthly consequence. I reason not of virtue and of sin, but do the deed he has put into my heart. I fear not for the angry frown of heaven. I flinch not from the red assault of hell. I crush the opposition of the gods, tread down a million goblin obstacles. I guide man to the path of the divine and guard him from the red wolf and the snake. I set in his mortal hand my heavenly sword and put on him the breastplate of the gods. I break the ignorant pride of human mind and lead the thought to the wideness of the truth. I rend man's narrow and successful life and force his sorrowful eyes to gaze at the sun, that he may die to earth and live in his soul. Well, we had to hear about Durga tonight, didn't we? Jai Ma. Namaste.